Hello. Welcome to today's program on careers. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, Irene Lubin, and this is Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today I'd like to begin our program with an article which appeared in the New York Times on the 3rd of April. Jobs and workers are in balance, but nobody is happy about it. This article was written for the New York Times by Lydia DePillis. Lower immigration has brought labor supply in line with a shaky demand, but economists are worrying that such a slow-moving job market is at risk of toppling over. In a healthy labor market, enough jobs are being created to soak up all the new people looking for work. But what if those numbers are essentially zilch? That is the conundrum facing Federal Reserve officials as they eye employment reports that have registered in the red for five of the last 12 months. The economy has added 156,000 jobs over the past year, the slowest pace since the COVID-19 pandemic, and before that, the aftermath of the financial crisis. The rate of hiring has fallen to lows from April 2020 and early 2010. And yet, in contrast to those economic cataclysms, the jobless are not lining up at unemployment offices. Because of President Trump's hard turn toward deportations and clampdown on legal immigration channels, there just are not that many new job seekers. You've got a sort of a zero employment growth equilibrium, said Jerome H. Powell, the Fed's chair at the central bank's meeting last month. Now that's balance, okay, but I would say it does have a feel of downside risk, and it's not kind of a really comfortable balance. The unease reflects the unfamiliar nature of a no-growth U.S. job market. The labor force has slowed down before, including during the Great Recession, when many immigrants who had come for construction jobs during the housing boom left after those opportunities evaporated. Their departure served as something of a safety valve, preventing unemployment from rising even higher. But labor force growth has never come to such a standstill outside that kind of a downturn, and it is accelerating the reality that now faces many developed countries. As birth rates dip, the working age population flatlines and may shrink, unless foreigners come in to refresh it. The United States was supposed to reach that point a few decades hence. Now it's already here. There is so much angst out there about the state of the economy right now, and that's because it is so different from what we have seen in recent decades, said Luc Pardue, policy director at the Aspen Institute's Economic Strategy Group. What we're seeing right now is a strong hint of what we will see in the future, given the current and projected demographic trends. The new equilibrium creates some challenges. Surmounting them, if the federal government remains committed to keeping foreigners out, would require some very focused effort. The harder questions. As long as a country has basic preconditions for prosperity, such as a functional government and universal education system, moderate population growth is a tailwind for living standards. More people mean more customers for goods and services, more available workers to execute on good ideas, and more opportunities to move around and grow. Think about the economy as a company. If it's growing, employees have an easier time moving to different roles as they learn and try new things, since the firm is able to backfill what they were doing before. When the business stays the same size, it's harder to maintain that trajectory, and workers may not fulfill their potential. It's possible to maintain a certain amount of churn and dynamism without adding workers. It's just more difficult. One person moving out of a position to take another job leaves a vacancy that may be tough to fill. For these big developed economies that have relatively stagnant populations, it makes all these trade-offs way more tangible, said Dietrich Wohlrath, who is a professor of economics at the University of Houston. You very much have to make choices that some places are going to shrink and do worse, and some places are going to do better. The growing, expanding population allows you to skip past the hard questions. And at the same time, the composition of the labor force is changing, adding more people in their 50s and their 60s, while fewer 20-somethings are getting started. Although age does bring some benefits, such as knowledge and experience, older people tend to be less likely to take the kinds of risks that create new ideas and businesses. They also are less well equipped for physical jobs, such as nursing and construction. Also, as workers retire, that labor force has to support a larger non-working population, and that creates two problems. One, Social Security is designed around adding taxpayers faster than they age out of the system. The equation has also long depended on immigrants who typically contribute payroll taxes and rarely get benefits in return. Slowing immigration has already moved up the date by which Social Security will become insolvent, which would force benefits cuts, tax increases, or both. And two, older people consume far more health care, which is inherently labor intensive. The sector is already essentially the only source of employment growth and probably could be growing faster if there were enough qualified workers. With a constrained labor force, satisfying health care demand means that some other part of the economy is going to need to make do with less. And finally, for both businesses and policymakers, there is something psychologically unnerving to the number zero. When the economy is not creating more jobs, employers may worry that people will have less disposable income and start to shrink their own payrolls in anticipation. Does Walmart say we have less demand in our stores? Let's extrapolate that out and assume that we're going to have less demand in 2026 than in 2025. And so we're going to build less, hire less, and expand less, said Wendy Edelberg, who is a former chief economist at the Congressional Budget Office. All of that can create its own momentum for a downturn. Wealth without growth? A flatlining population is by no means an economic death sentence. Plenty of countries are already dealing with it. The prototypical example of this is Japan, where even though the population has been sinking since 2008, the labor force there has been rebounding after a concerted effort to help women stay employed and with more robust child care and parental leave. Older people are working longer as well. When humans are not available, robots fill many menial positions, such as making the coffee and stocking the shelves. Another policy lever that can help places with low or negative population growth is helping people retrain and find new positions quickly if they do lose a job. The United States spends far less as a share of its economic output on these active labor market policies than do other wealthy nations, and might benefit from trying a bit harder to keep people in productive employment. Continuous education also helps make workers as productive as they can be, compensating for losses in manpower. Perhaps the best way to maintain a healthy economy, even as workforce growth slows, is to make sure that prosperity is widely shared, with high minimum wages and adequate health care. If people on the low end of the income spectrum are able to go to the movies and to remodel their homes, money keeps circulating and creating the demand for new goods and services. Other countries with stable or shrinking populations, including Japan, as well as Scandinavian nations, have much lower rates of inequality than the United States. Distribution can be an element that drives growth because it spreads out and creates a larger market. Mr. Volrath of the University of Houston said, "People starting businesses want to know if there are enough customers with the wherewithal to buy what they're selling. We'll all benefit from that," he said. "A more equitable distribution can create some scale for us that did not exist before." But the easiest policy fix is one that America is currently rejecting: allow more immigration. It's not just the size and the age structure of the workforce that matter here. New arrivals has historically been willing to take jobs that native-born workers have not wanted because, with the benefits of language and cultural fluency, they have better options. In that way, immigrants are like complementary ingredients in a recipe. If you don't have enough sugar, you can't make as many pies as you would like, so you use less flour. Natural experiments have buttressed this conclusion. In 2021 and 2022, U.S. companies that missed out on getting visas for seasonal workers saw reduced revenues and employed fewer native-born workers. And in South Korea, when a migrant worker program was suspended during the pandemic, companies went out of business and wages for Korean workers fell. "It's not like you can take away the migrant worker and you can replace them with a native worker," said Charles Kenny, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, who has argued that wealthy countries should welcome more migrants. "Really, what happens is the business closes down." This recipe math is accentuated by the potential dislocation of artificial intelligence, which appears very likely to destroy desk jobs for which there is no shortage of native-born workers. The occupations that have depended on most on immigrants, such as home health care and landscaping, will scarcely be affected. That is why some countries, without a long tradition of integrating people from many other places, have stepped up their efforts to recruit immigrants, if not as full citizens, then at least to supplement their own labor forces. That includes Japan as well as Italy, where even as the conservative premier, Giorgi Meloni, battles unauthorized migrants on land and on sea, she has quietly opened the door to 500,000 foreigners to work on their farms as caretakers for older people and in other essential settings. You have to balance the social and political implications against the economic need, said Lant Pritchett, who is a professor at the London School of Economics, who has studied ways to make migration more palatable in destination countries. Even a right-wing government who came to power on the premise that it was anti-immigrant realized that you cannot be anti-worker. The next article that I would like to read for you today is from the Arizona Republic, the 15th of March. Can job hopping have negative career impacts? This article was written as a special to USA Today and was written by Johnny C. Taylor, Jr. He begins with a question posed to him. The question is, "I have been job hopping every 1 to 2 years, and I am worried that I'm becoming unhirable. Is this no big deal nowadays, or is it a red flag that could harm my career?" From Ishahan. The response is, "The potentially negative optics of job hopping are a valid concern, so let's level set. Moving jobs every 1 to 2 years does not automatically make you unhirable. What does raise eyebrows, though, isn't how often you move, it's about why you move and how you leave. There is a distinction here too many professionals overlook. Leaving a job for thoughtful, legitimate reasons, such as career growth, a better fit, leadership changes, or evolving life circumstances, is very different from fleeing in frustration or burning bridges on the way out. Employers do not automatically react negatively to movement, but they do worry about patterns that signal poor judgment, instability, or drama. Here's what hiring managers really do care about. When you were there, did you deliver results? Did you handle yourself professionally, especially when things got hard? And would your former manager say, "I'd hire him again"? Strong performance and credibility do matter far more than an arbitrary length of stay. If your work was solid and your exit was respectful, shorter tenures become much easier to explain. This means that you have to own your choices. If a role was not a good fit from the beginning, say so. But don't blame, complain, or overshare. Explain what you were looking for, what you learned, and how you experienced with that experience inform your next move. Growth requires accountability. Excuses do not age well. I've personally supported people moving on from roles I knew wouldn't be long-term, and that's not a failure. Careers today are not built the way they were 30 years ago. What matters is whether someone showed up, contributed, and managed transitions with integrity. Leaders remember these things, and many are willing to help later if those boxes were checked. This is where reputation comes in. Maintain your relationships. Stay connected to former managers and colleagues. Do not underestimate how small industries really are. Resumes open doors, but references and reputations decide who walks through them. At the end of the day, job hopping does not derail careers. Poor judgment does, though. If you are consistently delivering value, treating people well, and leaving roles the right way, your career is not in trouble. Employers do not expect lifetime loyalty these days, but they do expect professionalism, contribution, and accountability. Careers are not defined by movement. They're defined by the impression you leave behind. Make sure yours tells the right story. The author of this article, Johnny C. Taylor, Jr., is president and CEO of SHRM, the world's largest trade association of human resources professionals, and author of Reset, A Leader's Guide to Work in an Age of Upheaval. The views and opinions expressed in this column are the author's only and do not necessarily reflect those of the newspaper USA Today. The next article that I would like to read for you on today's program was taken from the Wall Street Journal, the 26th of March. The article's title is Finding the Best Place to Work. Theo Francis and Andrew Molika co-wrote this article. It hasn't been easy to find an employer that is a good fit. Job seekers today often have little more to guide them than word of mouth, social media chatter, and websites offering glimpses of pay and benefits. Many end up churning through jobs or finding themselves stuck in a career cul-de-sac. Now, a new analysis provides a potential roadmap. It points to companies best at hiring early career candidates, moving employees up through the ranks, and providing a stable home base for a career, both overall and for specific roles. The Where You Work Matters list by the Burning Glass Institute and Schultz Family Foundation looked at the job titles and career moves of more than 12 million people working at more than 1,700 U.S. companies and nonprofits as well from 2019 to 2024. My hope is that this can be a nutrition label for workers, that it can give them more agency for making better informed decisions that are of tremendous consequence to them, said Matt Ziegelman, who is president of the Burning Glass Institute, a labor market think tank focused on the future of work. Just 22 companies, from General Motors to the Mayo Clinic and Fidelity Investments, received top marks across the board. Many have developed specific strategies to foster employees' careers. Finding the right fit is critical in a job market headlined by layoffs and hiring freezes and clouded by artificial intelligence and automation. The kind of job insecurity that once seemed the province of hourly blue-collar jobs haunts white-collar professions these days. Especially now, workers are better off at companies with track records of advancing their employees' careers rather than those treating workers as expendable, said Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who is a managing director at the Schultz Family Foundation. The foundation, started by former Starbucks chairperson and chief executive Howard Schultz and his wife Sherry, focuses on issues of economic mobility. Having mobility strength is like having done the physical training and having the whole canteen of water as you hike up that mountain, Chandrasekaran said. The analysis tracked people working in 55,000 jobs and assumed their early career opportunities, career growth, and job stability, including pay, across 553 occupation groups. It crunched data from LinkedIn, from Indeed, Glassdoor, and dozens of other sources. The top 20% of companies for each group were awarded a platinum designation, while the next 20% got a gold status. Companies with the most occupation-level distinctions could receive company-wide platinum or gold designations. The best place to work may not be obvious. Financial and investment analysts, for example, might find better jobs outside the financial industry. More tech companies than financial firms got top marks across the board for the analyst positions. And other companies scoring well for financial analyst careers, Bath & Body Works, Nike, and Verizon Communications. Likewise, tech companies such as Microsoft and Amazon made up less than a quarter of the list's top-rated employers of data scientists. Just as many of the high-performing companies were in finance and insurance, including Capital One and Citadel Securities. And most of the top-scoring companies for data scientists came from other industries entirely, including Walmart and Domino's Pizza. Those working in food and beverage services should consider applying to the top performers, including Costco, Texas-based grocer H-E-B, or even the restaurants inside IKEA stores, according to the list. Working at a top-scoring company has concrete benefits, the list creators say. Employees at companies receiving top ranks overall are more likely to earn more, stay at least 3 years, be promoted within 5 years, and land a better job elsewhere once they do leave. The exact degree of benefit varies by occupation. Chipotle Mexican Grill received gold overall and platinum for early career jobs. About half of its occupation groups, including cooks and food service managers, received platinum for both early career and career growth. More received either platinum or gold in at least one area. The company credits, in part, a clear promotion structure that can bring a restaurant line worker through 6 roles over 3.5 years to a step beyond restaurant manager, where annual cash and equity generally exceeds $100,000. Education programs, including tuition reimbursement, available within about 4 months of hire, help to attract job candidates, and those that use the programs tend to stick around longer and get promoted faster, the company says. Job candidates should not rule out a company just because it didn't get high marks overall. Those employers can still score well for particular occupations. Likewise, specific jobs at platinum companies may not score well. We're used to thinking about there being good companies and bad companies, Siegelman said. The reality, though, is that there are good jobs and bad jobs at any given company. Newell Brands, maker of Rubbermaid containers and Yankee Candles, is not in the top-ranked companies overall, but three-quarters of its job categories got high marks for career growth. That company says it seeks to identify promising employees for promotion, encourages career planning alongside performance reviews, and pores over internal data to spot potential matches for open positions, even among employees who have not yet applied. We used to have a post and pray model, said Bill Huffaker, Newell's Senior Vice President for Talent Development. Now we go after passive candidates. A recent article in the Wall Street Journal looked at people who were white-collar workers who took on trade jobs. Learn a trade isn't just a rallying cry for younger generations to skip college and pursue in-demand blue-collar work. For burned-out white-collar workers, it has become a popular mid-career fantasy, and also fears of artificial intelligence. Job popculists have prompted more than a few professionals to contemplate life as a plumber or an HVAC specialist. Here's another one who did go from white collar to a trade job. Ben Neville, who is 32, was a CPA turned pilot in training in Washington, D.C. 5 years of paying $500 a month for a bedroom in a shared apartment on an accountant's salary enabled Ben Neville to train for a new career as a pilot. He has spent $130,000 in lessons and plane rentals so far, using the money he saved by living cheaply so long. If you couldn't self-fund or get a loan, it's easy to get stuck, he says. That wasn't his original plan. The son of a stay-at-home mom and shipyard worker, he got a double major in finance and Chinese from the College of William and Mary, then a master's in accounting. After a year of working often 80 hours a week at Ernst & Young, he took an accounting job with the Navy. By 2024, he was earning $160,000 a year. But he did want more. His only previous experience with flying had been flying as a passenger in coach. So he started with flying lessons and moved on up from there. As he says, it's not about the money. There's always something to learn. It keeps you on your toes. It's almost the opposite of a desk job. I go up in a plane on a Saturday, and 1 hour later, I'm at the beach. This is all we have time for on our program on careers for today. I hope that you've enjoyed listening in and will enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for listening in. I'm Irene Lubin, a volunteer reader, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.